Paul can here use the word appear. It's the same thing from a different angle, and this helps us to demystify the idea that the coming of Jesus means that he will descend like a spaceman from the sky. Jesus is at present in heaven, but, as we saw earlier, heaven, being God's space, is not somewhere within the space of our world, but is rather a different, though closely related, space. The promise is not that Jesus will simply reappear within the present world order, but that when heaven and earth are joined together in the new way God has promised, then he will appear to us, and we will appear to him and to one another in our own true identity. This is, in fact, remarkably close to a key passage in the first letter of John, 1 John chapter 2, verses 28 and chapter 3, verse 2. Now children abide in him, so that when he appears, ean phanero de, we may have confidence and not be shrink from him in shame at his presence. Parousia. Beloved, we are now God's children, and it has not yet appeared, upo ephanerothi, what we shall be. But we know that when he appears, ean phanerothi, we shall be like him, because we shall see him just as he is. Here we have more or less exactly the same picture as in Colossians, though this time with appearing and parousia happily side by side. Of course, when he appears, he will be present. But the point of stressing appearing here is that, though in one sense it will seem to us that he is coming, he will in fact be appearing right where he presently is, not a long way away within our own space-time world, but in his own world, God's world, the world we call heaven. This world is different from ours, earth, but intersects with it in countless ways, not least in the inner lives of Christians themselves. One day the two worlds will be integrated completely and be fully visible to one another, producing that transformation of which both Paul and John speak. Of course, Paul and John are not the only writers to mention all of this. The revelation of St. John the Divine also speaks of the coming of Jesus. And here we find the word come itself. The Spirit and the Bride say, come. And the closing prayer of the book, as with 1 Corinthians, is that the Lord Jesus will come and come soon. The same theme is scattered elsewhere in the book. There is no space here to look at these passages in detail, or indeed at the relevant passages in the other, smaller New Testament books. The one place in the New Testament where the issue of delay is addressed head-on is, famously, 2 Peter chapter 3. And it's worth noting that those who reckon this is a problem are precisely in context those who are arguing for a rather different, non-historical form of Christianity. What we have here, with minor variations, is a remarkably unanimous view spread throughout the early Christianity known to us. There will come a time, which might indeed come at any time, when, in the great renewal of the world that Easter itself foreshadowed, Jesus himself will be personally present and will be the agent and model of the transformation that will happen both to the whole world and also to believers. This expectation and hope, expressed so clearly in the New Testament, continues undiminished in the second and subsequent centuries. Mainstream Christians, throughout the early period, were not worried by the fact that the event had not happened within a generation. The idea that the problem of delay set out in 2 Peter chapter 3 was widespread in second-generation Christianity is a modern scholar's myth rather than a historical reality. Nor was the idea of Jesus's appearing or coming simply part of a tradition that was passed on uncritically without later generations really tuning in to what it was saying. As with the ascension, so with Jesus's appearing, it was seen as a vital part of a full presentation of the Jesus who was and is to come. Without it, the Church's proclamation makes no sense. Take it away, and all sorts of things start to unravel. The early Christians saw this as clearly as anyone since, and we would do well to learn from them. But it is now high time to look at the second aspect of the appearing or coming of Jesus. When he comes, according to the same biblically grounded tradition, he will have a specific role to play, that of judge. 9. Jesus, the coming judge. Introduction. From the very beginning of Christianity, it's already there in some of the earliest traditions, we discover the belief that the Jesus who will appear at the end will take the role of judge. This is not an isolated belief. Indeed, within its Jewish context, it is more readily explicable than the parousia itself. However, it's important that we explore its meaning within early Christianity and its significance for today and tomorrow. The picture of Jesus as the coming judge is the central feature of another absolutely vital and non-negotiable Christian belief, that there will indeed be a judgment in which the Creator God will set the world right once and for all. The word judgment carries negative overtones for a good many people in our liberal and post-liberal world. We need to remind ourselves that throughout the Bible, not least in the Psalms, God's coming judgment is a good thing, something to be celebrated, longed for, yearned over. It causes people to shout for joy and the trees of the field to clap their hands. In a world of systematic injustice, bullying, violence, arrogance, and oppression, the thought that there might come a day when the wicked are firmly put in their place and the poor and weak are given their due is the best news there can be. Faced with a world in rebellion, a world full of exploitation and wickedness, a good God must be a God of judgment. The liberal optimism of the 19th century had a long run for its money, outlasting some of the more obvious counterarguments provided by the huge systemic evil of the 20th century. But more recent theology has returned to the theme of judgment, recognizing that the biblical analysis of evil corresponds more closely to reality. The Old Testament hope for the Creator God to bring judgment and justice to the world, to set the world right, became focused in the later biblical period on Israel's longing to see God overturn the oppressive regimes of the pagan world. It would be like a great cosmic court scene. Israel, or at least the righteous within Israel, would play the part of the helpless defendant. The Gentiles, or at least the particularly wicked ones, would play the part of the arrogant bullies, who would at last meet their match and get the justice, the judgment, they deserved. The most famous scenario expressing all this is Daniel chapter 7. There the Gentile nations are depicted as huge, powerful monsters, while Israel, or the righteous within Israel, is depicted as an apparently defenseless human being, one like a son of man. The scene is a great court setting whose climax comes when the judge, the Ancient of Days, takes his seat and rules in favor of the son of man against the monsters, in favor of Israel against the pagan empires. The son of man is then given authority and dominion over all the nations, in a deliberate echo of Adam, being given authority over the animals in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. What happens when this is transposed to the New Testament? Answer: we find Jesus himself taking on the role of the Son of Man, suffering, then vindicated. Then, as in Daniel, he receives from the Supreme Judge the task of bringing this judgment to bear on the world. This accords with many biblical and post-biblical passages in which Israel's Messiah, the one who represents Israel in person, is given the task of judgment. In Isaiah chapter 11, the Messiah's judgment creates a world where the wolf and the lamb lie down side by side. In Psalm 2, the Gentiles tremble when the Messiah is enthroned. Again and again the Messiah is stated to be God's agent, to bring the whole world, not just Israel, back into the state of justice and truth for which God longs as much as we do. So the early Christians, who had concluded from Easter that Jesus was indeed the Messiah, naturally identified him as the one through whom God would put the world to rights. They didn't simply deduce this from their belief in his future coming or appearing. Actually, it may have been the other way around. Their belief in Jesus' messiahship may have been a decisive factor in the emergence of the belief in his final coming as judge. Certainly by the time of Paul, this belief is well established. Paul's speech on the Areopagus in Athens concludes with the statement that God has fixed a day on which he will judge the world by a man whom he has appointed, giving assurance of the fact by raising him from the dead. Paul can refer almost casually in Romans chapter 2 verse 16 to the fact that according to the gospel he preaches, God will judge the secrets of all hearts through Jesus the Messiah. Although people often suppose that because Paul taught justification by faith, not works, there can be no room for a future judgment according to works, this only goes to show how much some have radically misunderstood him. The future judgment according to deeds, a judgment exercised by Jesus at his judgment seat, is clearly taught in, for instance, Romans chapter 14 verses 9 to 10, 2 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 10, and elsewhere. Equally important, these are not isolated places where Paul is quoting a tradition that doesn't fully fit with his developed theology. They are fully and tightly integrated into his thinking and preaching. For him, as much as for anyone else in the early church, the final judgment exercised by Jesus the Messiah was a vital element, without which all sorts of other things simply wouldn't stand up. In particular, though there isn't space to develop this here, this picture of future judgment according to works is actually the basis of Paul's theology of justification by faith. The point of justification by faith isn't that God suddenly ceases to care about good behavior or morality. Justification by faith cannot be collapsed, as so many in the last two centuries tried to do, either into a generalized, liberal view of a laissez-faire morality, or into the romantic view that what we do outwardly doesn't matter at all, since the only thing that matters is what we're like inwardly. Those who over-anxiously defend a doctrine from which all mention of works has been rigorously excluded should consider with whom they are colluding at this point. No. Justification by faith is what happens in the present time, anticipating the verdict of the future day when God judges the world. It is God's advance declaration that when someone believes the gospel, that person is already a member of his family, no matter who their parents were, that their sins are forgiven because of Jesus' death, and that on the future day, as Paul says, there is now no condemnation. Romans chapter 8 verse 1. Clearly further questions can be asked about how the verdict issued in the present can so confidently be supposed to anticipate correctly the verdict issued in the future on the basis of the entire life led. Paul addresses those questions in several ways at several points, particularly in his expositions of the work of the Holy Spirit. But for Paul, and this is the only point I am making in the present context, there was no clash between present justification by faith and future judgment according to works. The two actually need and depend upon one another. To go any further would demand a fairly thorough exposition of Romans and Galatians, for which there is obviously no space here. Once again, the Pauline picture is filled out by other references in the New Testament. This is no flash in the pan or Pauline idiosyncrasy. It is common early Christian belief. It is the central point in that long paragraph in John chapter 5, verses 22 to 30, which caused so many headaches to those earlier scholars who tried to make John's gospel teach simply a present eternal life rather than also the future one. The Father doesn't judge anyone. He has handed over all judgment to the Son, so that everyone should honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Anyone who doesn't honor the Son doesn't honor the Father who sent him. I'm telling you the solemn truth. Anyone who hears my word and believes in the one who sent me has eternal life. Such a person won't come into judgment. They will have passed out of death into life. I'm telling you the solemn truth. The time is coming. In fact, it's here already, when the dead will hear the voice of God's Son, and those who hear it will live. You see, just as the Father has life in himself, in the same way he has given the Son the privilege of having life in himself. He has even given him authority to pass judgment, because he is the Son of Man. Don't be surprised at this. The time is coming, you see, when everyone in the tombs will hear his voice. They will come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. I can't do anything on my own authority. I judge on the basis of what I hear, and my judgment is just, because I'm not trying to carry out my own wishes, but the wishes of the one who sent me. The main point to notice, once more, is that all the future judgment is highlighted basically as good news, not bad. Why so? It is good news, first, because the one through whom God's justice will finally sweep the world is not a hard-hearted, arrogant or vengeful tyrant, but rather the man of sorrows, who was acquainted with grief, the Jesus who loved sinners and died for them, the Messiah who took the world's judgment upon himself on the cross. Of course, this also means that he is uniquely placed to judge the systems and rulers that have carved up the world between them, and the New Testament points this out here and there. In particular, as we have already seen, and as some medieval theologians and artists highlighted, Jesus comes as judge, much as Moses descended the mountain into the camp where idolatry and revelry were in full swing. The Sistine Chapel itself reminds us of the day when careless and casual living, as well as downright wickedness, will be brought to book. Within the New Testament and within subsequent Christian theology, this judgment is anticipated under certain circumstances. I have already spoken of justification by faith. The same is true in 1 Corinthians for the Eucharist. Eating and drinking the body and blood of Jesus means confronting here and now the one who is the judge as well as the Savior of all. And the same is true, of course, of the work of the Spirit, as we see once more in John chapter 16. When the Spirit comes, declares Jesus, he will convict the world of sin, of righteousness and judgment. The final judgment, in other words, will be anticipated in the present world through the Spirit-led work and witness of Jesus' followers. Second Coming and Judgment. The so-called Second Coming of Jesus, then, when properly understood in the New Testament and subsequent Christian teaching, is no afterthought to the basic Christian message. It hasn't been, as it were, bolted onto the outside of a gospel message that could stand complete without it. We cannot relegate it to the margins of our thinking, our living, and our praying. If we do, we shall pull everything else out of shape. I now want, briefly, to draw out a few final points of relevance for us today. First, the appearing or coming of Jesus offers the complete answer to both the literalist fundamentalists and to the proponents of that cosmic Christ idea I outlined in chapter 5. Jesus remains other than the church, other than the world, even while being present to both by the Spirit. He confronts the world in the present and will do so personally and visibly in the future. He is the one to whom every knee shall bow, Philippians chapter 2 verses 10 to 11, as well as the one who took the form of a servant and was obedient to the death of the cross, Philippians chapter 2 verses 6 to 8. Indeed, as Paul stresses, he is the first because he did the second. In his appearing, we find neither a dualist rejection of the present world, nor simply his arrival like a spaceman into the present world, but rather the transformation of the present world and ourselves within it, so that it will at last be put to rights, and we with it. Death and decay will be overcome, and God will be all in all. This means, second, that a proper shape and balance are given to the Christian worldview. Like the Jewish worldview, but radically opposed to the Stoic, the Platonic, the Hindu, and the Buddhist worldviews, the Christian worldview is a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. Not to have closure at the end of the story, to be left with a potentially endless cycle round and round with either the same things happening again and again, or simply perhaps the long outworking of karma, would be the very antithesis of the story told by the apostles and by the long line of their Jewish predecessors. And precisely because Jesus is not collapsed into the church, or indeed the world, we can renounce both the triumphalism that conveniently makes his sovereign lordship an excuse for its own, and the despair that comes when we see such hopes dashed, as they always will be, in the follies and failings of even the best and greatest Christian organizations, structures, leaders, and followers. Because we live between ascension and appearing, joined to Jesus Christ by the Spirit, but still awaiting his final coming and presence, we can be both properly humble and properly confident. We proclaim not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants through Jesus. Third, following directly from this, the task of the church between ascension and parousia is therefore set free both from the self-driven energy that imagines it has to build God's kingdom all by itself, and from the despair that supposes it can't do anything until Jesus comes again. We do not build the kingdom all by ourselves, but we do build for the kingdom. All that we do in faith, hope, and love in the present, in obedience to our ascended Lord, and in the power of the Spirit, will be enhanced and transformed at his appearing. This too brings a note of judgment, of course, as Paul makes clear in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 10 to 17. The day will disclose what sort of work each builder has done. In particular, the present rule of the ascended Jesus Christ and the assurance of his final appearing in judgment should give us, which goodness knows we need today, some clarity and realism in our political discourse. Far too often Christians slide into a vaguely spiritualized version of one or other major political system or party. What would happen if we were to take seriously our stated belief that Jesus Christ is already the Lord of the world, and that at his name one day every knee would bow? You might suppose that this would merely inject a note of pietism, and make us then avoid the real issues, or indeed to attempt a theocratic takeover bid. But to think in either of those ways would only show how deeply we have been conditioned by the Enlightenment split between religion and politics. What happens if we reintegrate them? As with specifically Christian work, so with political work done in Jesus' name, confessing Jesus as the ascended and coming Lord frees us up from needing to pretend that this or that program or leader has the key to utopia, if only we would elect him or her. Equally, it frees up our corporate life from the despair that comes when we realize that once again our political systems let us down. The ascension and appearing of Jesus constitute a radical challenge to the entire thought structure of the Enlightenment, and of course several other movements. And since our present Western politics is very much the creation of the Enlightenment, we should think seriously about the ways in which, as thinking Christians, we can and should bring that challenge to bear. I know this is giving a huge hostage to fortune, raising questions to which I certainly don't know the answers, but I do know that unless I point all this out, one might easily get the impression that these ancient doctrines are of theoretical or abstract interest only. They aren't. People who believe that Jesus is already Lord and that he will appear again as judge of the world are called and equipped, to put it mildly, to think and act quite differently in the world from those who don't. I shall pursue these questions a bit further in the final part of the book. In particular, of course, the hope of Jesus' coming as judge to put right all that is wrong in the world and to give new life to the dead is the context for one of our central themes, to which we can at last turn. If all this is so, what can we say about the future that awaits every one of us, every baptized believer in Jesus Christ? What precisely do we mean for ourselves when we speak of the future resurrection? 10. The redemption of our bodies. Introduction. As we saw in the first two chapters, there is no agreement in the church today about what happens to people when they die. Not surprisingly, therefore, there is also confusion in the wider non-Christian world, not only about the fate of the dead, but also about what Christians are supposed to believe on the subject. This is all the more curious in that the New Testament itself, which most churches officially regard as their primary doctrinal source, is crystal clear on the matter. In a classic passage, Paul speaks of the redemption of our bodies, Romans chapter 8, verse 23. There is no room for doubt as to what he means. God's people are promised a new type of bodily existence, the fulfillment and redemption of our present bodily life. The rest of the early Christian writings, where they address the subject, are completely in tune with this. This expression of hope, hope for the resurrection of the body, was, however, so out of tune with several of the prevailing moods of Christian thought down the years that it became muzzled and distorted, and then not even known. In this chapter, I shall lay out the basic picture of final bodily resurrection offered by the New Testament and the early church fathers, and explain how I think it can be re-emphasized today. This can be done briefly because I am merely drawing together what I have set out in much more detail elsewhere. My proposition is that the traditional picture of people going to either heaven or hell as a one-stage post-mortem journey, with or without the option of some kind of purgatory or continuing journey as an intermediate stage, represents a serious distortion and diminution of the Christian hope. Bodily resurrection is not just one odd bit of that hope. It is the element that gives shape and meaning to the rest of the story we tell about God's ultimate purposes. If we squeeze it to the margins, as many have done by implication, or indeed if we leave it out altogether, as some have done quite explicitly, we don't just lose an extra feature like buying a car that happens not to have electrically operated mirrors. We lose the central engine which drives it and gives every other component its reason for working. Instead of talking vaguely about heaven and then trying to fit the language of resurrection into that, we should talk with biblical precision about the resurrection and reorganize our language about heaven around that. What is more, as I shall show in the final part of this book, when we do this, we discover an excellent foundation, not, as some suppose, for an escapist or quietist piety, that belongs more with the traditional and misleading language about heaven, but for lively and creative Christian work within the present world. Resurrection, life after death. We saw in the second chapter that whereas Greco-Roman paganism and Second Temple Judaism both held a wide variety of beliefs about life beyond death, the early Christians were remarkably unanimous on the topic. There is space here only for a brief survey of the massive evidence. We begin once more with Paul. I stressed in the previous chapter that when Paul speaks in Philippians chapter 3 of being citizens of heaven, he doesn't mean that we shall retire there when we have finished our work here. He says in the next line that Jesus will come from heaven in order to transform the present humble body into a glorious body like his own, and that he will do this by the power through which he makes all things subject to himself. This little statement contains in a nutshell more or less all Paul's thought on the subject. The risen Jesus is both the model for the Christian's future body and the means by which it comes about. Similarly, in Colossians chapter 3 verses 1 to 4, when the Messiah appears, the one who is your life, then you too will appear with him in glory. Paul does not say, one day you will go to be with him. No, you already possess life in him. This new life, which the Christian possesses secretly, invisible to the world, will burst forth into full bodily reality and visibility. The clearest and strongest passage, often ignored, is Romans chapter 8, verses 9 to 11. If the Spirit of God, the Spirit of Jesus, the Messiah, dwells in you, says Paul, then the one who raised the Messiah from the dead will give life to your mortal bodies as well, through his Spirit who dwells in you. God will give life, not to a disembodied spirit, not to what many people have thought of as a spiritual body in the sense of a non-physical one, but to your mortal bodies also. Paul is not the only New Testament writer to hold this view. The first letter of John declares that when Jesus appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. The resurrection body of Jesus, which at the moment is almost unimaginable to us in its glory and power, will be the model for our own. And of course, within John's Gospel, despite the puzzlement of those who want to read the book in a very different way, we have some of the clearest statements of future bodily resurrection. Jesus reaffirms the widespread Jewish expectation of resurrection and announces that the hour for this has already arrived. In the passage we glanced at in the previous chapter, it is quite explicit. "The hour is coming," he says. "Indeed, it is already here, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. When all in the graves will come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment." This clearly depends on Daniel chapter 12 and other passages such as Isaiah chapter 26 and Ezekiel chapter 37. It exhibits a surface tension with the position of Paul, who mostly seems to regard resurrection as God's future gift by the Spirit for those who are in Christ, not for everyone, though, as we shall see presently, 2 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 10 may indicate otherwise. Some of the early church fathers enthusiastically follow John at this point, emphasizing that resurrection is necessary for the wicked as well, so that they may be judged in the body. To this we shall return. Here we need to revisit a point we made earlier. What does Jesus mean when he declares that there are many dwelling places in his Father's house? This has regularly been taken, not least when used in the context of bereavement, to mean that the dead, or at least dead Christians, will simply go to heaven permanently, rather than being raised again subsequently to new bodily life. But the word for dwelling places here, monai, is regularly used in ancient Greek not for a final resting place, but for a temporary halt on a journey that will take you somewhere else in the long run. This fits closely with Jesus' words to the dying brigand in Luke, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Despite a long tradition of misreading, paradise is here, as in some other Jewish writing, not a final destination, but the blissful garden, the parkland of rest and tranquility, where the dead are refreshed as they await the dawn of the new day. The main point of the sentence lies in the apparent contrast between the brigand's request and Jesus' reply. "Remember me," he says, "when you come in your kingdom," implying, whether ironically or not does not concern us here, that this will be at some far distant future. Jesus' answer brings this future hope into the present, implying, of course, that with his death the kingdom is indeed coming, even though it doesn't look like what anyone had imagined. "Today you will be with me in paradise." There will still, of course, be a future completion involving ultimate resurrection. Luke's overall theological understanding leaves no doubt on that score. Jesus, after all, didn't rise again today, that is, on Good Friday. Luke must have understood him to be referring to a state of being in paradise, which would be true for him and for the man dying beside him at once that very day. In other words, prior to the resurrection. With Jesus, the future hope has come forward into the present. For those who die in faith, before that final reawakening, the central promise is of being with Jesus at once. "My desire is to depart," wrote Paul, "and be with Christ, which is far better." Resurrection itself then appears as what the word always meant, whether, like the ancient pagans, people disbelieved it, or whether, like many ancient Jews, they affirmed it. It wasn't a way of talking about life after death. It was a way of talking about a new bodily life after whatever state of existence one might enter immediately upon death. It was, in other words, life after death. What then about such passages as 1 Peter chapter 1, which speak of a salvation that is kept in heaven for you, so that in your present believing you are receiving the salvation of your souls. Here, I suggest, the automatic assumption of Western Christianity leads us badly astray. Most Christians today, reading a passage like this, assume that it means that heaven is where you go to receive this salvation, or even that salvation consists in going to heaven when you die. This then provides a dangerously distorted framework within which some of the key gospel sayings are interpreted, such as those in Matthew, where Jesus talks of entering the kingdom of heaven, or having a reward in heaven, or storing up riches in heaven. Quite simply, the way we now understand that language in the Western world is totally different from what Jesus and his hearers meant and understood. For a start, heaven is actually a reverent way of speaking about God, so that riches in heaven simply means riches in God's presence. As we see when elsewhere, Jesus talks about someone being or not being rich toward God. But then, by derivation from this primary meaning, heaven is the place where God's purposes for the future are stored up. It isn't where they are meant to stay so that one would need to go to heaven to enjoy them. It is where they are kept safe against the day when they will become a reality on earth. If I say to a friend, "I've kept some beer in the fridge for you," that doesn't mean that he has to climb into the fridge in order to drink the beer. God's future inheritance, the incorruptible new world and the new bodies that are to inhabit that world, are already kept safe, waiting for us. Not so that we can go to heaven and put them on there, but so that they can be brought to birth in this world, or rather in the new heavens and new earth, the renewed world of which I spoke earlier. We should note as well, in relation to the passage in 1 Peter and some others, that the word soul is rare in this sense in the early Christian writings. The word psyche was very common in the ancient world and carried a variety of meanings. Despite its frequency both in later Christianity and, for instance, in Buddhism, the New Testament doesn't use it to describe, so to speak, the bit of you that will ultimately be saved. The word psyche seems here to refer, like the Hebrew nephesh, not to a disembodied inner part of the human being, but to what we might call the person, or even the personality. And the point in 1 Peter chapter 1 is that this person, the real you, is already being saved, and will one day receive that salvation in full bodily form. That is why Peter quite rightly plants the hope for salvation firmly in the resurrection of Jesus. God has, he says, given us new birth to a living hope by the resurrection of Jesus the Messiah from the dead. Resurrection in Corinth. All discussions of the future resurrection must sooner or later do business with Paul, and particularly with his two letters to Corinth. These are tricky and controversial, and I've spent a long time elsewhere going through them in detail. Let me simply sum up the main argument, working back from 2 Corinthians to 1 Corinthians. The passage about resurrection in 2 Corinthians, chapters 4 and 5, comes within Paul's long and passionate description of his own apostleship. He speaks of his ministry in terms of having treasure in jars of clay, to show that what matters is God's power and not his own. To give substance to this, he spells out the future hope within which the present life of ambiguity and suffering makes sense. If all we had were the final verses of chapter 4, it might be possible to say, and some do try to argue this, that Paul was referring to a future hope in which the body would be left behind and a pure spirit would remain. The outer nature, he says, is wasting away, but the inner nature is being renewed day by day. Is this not three-quarters of the way down the road to Plato, eager to be done with the perishable mortal body and to be left with the glorious immortal and disembodied soul? Certainly not. In chapter 5, Paul speaks of the new tent or tabernacle that is waiting for us. There is a new house, a new dwelling, a new body waiting within God's sphere, again heaven, ready for us to put it on over the present one so that what is mortal may be swallowed up with life. As always, so here, Paul insists that God will accomplish this by the Spirit. This is the point at which we modern Westerners are called to make a huge leap of the imagination. We have been buying our mental furniture for so long in Plato's factory that we have come to take for granted a basic ontological contrast between spirit, in the sense of something immaterial, and matter, in the sense of something material, solid, physical. We think we know that solid objects are one sort of thing, and ideas or values or spirits or ghosts are a different sort of thing, often not noticing that they are themselves all rather different sorts of things. We know that bodies decay and die, that houses, temples, cities, and civilizations fall to dust, and so we assume that to be bodily, to be physical, is to be impermanent, changeable, transitory, and that the only way to be permanent, unchanging, and immortal is to become non-physical. Paul's point here is that this is not so. Actually, it wasn't so even in the dominant cosmology of his day, which was Stoic rather than Platonic. Still less was it so within the Jewish creation theology, which formed the seedbed out of which, because of the resurrection of Jesus himself, Paul grew his theology of new creation. Paul is making his Corinthian readers think in new patterns, and he has the same effect on us. What Paul is asking us to imagine is that there will be a new mode of physicality which stands in relation to our present body as our present body does to a ghost. It will be as much more real, more firmed up, more bodily than our present body as our present body is more substantial, more touchable than a disembodied spirit. We sometimes speak of someone who's been very ill as being a shadow of their former self. If Paul is right, a Christian in the present life is a mere shadow of his or her future self, the self that person will be when the body that God has waiting in his heavenly storeroom is brought out, already made to measure, and put on over the present one, or over the self that will still exist after bodily death. This is where one of the great Easter hymns gets it exactly right. Oh, how glorious and resplendent, fragile body shalt thou be, when endued with so much beauty, full of health, and strong and free, full of vigor, full of pleasure, that shall last eternally. Paul is anxious not to pretend he has already attained this state. Indeed, he is anxious to stress that the present work of an apostle involves him precisely in sharing the weakness and suffering of the present state of the world. But his point is that we must all appear before the judgment seat of the Messiah, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10, and for that we shall need bodies. Here Paul, like John, is on track with Daniel chapter 12 and other similar Jewish texts. Indeed, it may be at this point that Paul hints, after all, at a resurrection of the wicked in order to be judged in the body as well as of the righteous. This brings us to the heart of the New Testament view of the resurrection, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. The hope of resurrection underlies the whole of 1 Corinthians, not just chapter 15. But here, Paul addresses it head-on, as of central importance. Some in Corinth are denying the future resurrection, almost certainly on the normal pagan grounds that everyone knows dead people don't rise again. In reply, Paul speaks, as we saw in the previous chapter, of Jesus as the first fruits, and of the great harvest still to come when all Jesus' people are raised as he has been. The whole chapter echoes and alludes to Genesis chapters 1 to 3. It is a theology of new creation, not of the abandonment of creation. The heart of the chapter is an exposition of the two different types of bodies, the present one and the future one. This is where all sorts of problems have arisen. Several popular translations, notably the Revised Standard Version and its offshoots, translate Paul's key phrases as a physical body and a spiritual body. Simply in terms of the Greek words Paul uses, this cannot be correct. The technical arguments are overwhelming and conclusive. The contrast is between the present body, corruptible, decaying, and doomed to die, and the future body, incorruptible, undecaying, never to die again. The key adjectives, which are quoted endlessly in discussions of this topic, do not refer to a physical body and a non-physical one, which is how people in our culture are bound to hear the words physical and spiritual. The first word, psychikos, does not in any case mean anything like physical in our sense. For Greek speakers of Paul's day, the psyche, from which the word derives, means the soul, not the body. But the deeper underlying point is that adjectives of this type, Greek adjectives ending in ikos, describe not the material out of which things are made, but the power or energy that animates them. It is the difference between asking, on the one hand, is this a wooden ship or an iron ship, the material from which it is made, and asking, on the other, is this a steamship or a sailing ship, the energy that powers it. Paul is talking about the present body, which is animated by the normal human psyche, the life force we all possess here and now, which gets us through the present life but is ultimately powerless against illness, injury, decay, and death, and the future body, which is animated by God's pneuma, God's breath of new life, the energizing power of God's new creation. This is why, in a further phrase that became controversial as early as the mid-second century, Paul declares that flesh and blood cannot inherit God's kingdom. He doesn't mean that physicality will be abolished. Flesh and blood is a technical term for that which is corruptible, transient, heading for death. The contrast, again, is not between what we call physical and what we call non-physical, but between corruptible physicality on the one hand and incorruptible physicality on the other. This underlies the remarkable concluding verse of 1 Corinthians chapter 15, to which we shall return. For Paul, the bodily resurrection does not leave us saying, "So that's all right, we shall go at the last to join Jesus in a non-bodily platonic heaven," but, "So then, since the person you are and the world God has made will be gloriously reaffirmed in God's eventual future, you must be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the Lord's work, because you know that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." Belief in the bodily resurrection includes the belief that what is done in the present, in the body, by the power of the Spirit, will be reaffirmed in the eventual future, in ways at which we can presently only guess. Resurrection later debates. There were, of course, all kinds of debates and further discussions about the bodily resurrection in the second century and beyond. What is remarkable is that apart from the small corpus of Gnostic and semi-Gnostic writings, the early church fathers, at least as far as Origen, insisted on this doctrine, though the pressures on them to abandon it must have been very great. Ignatius of Antioch, Justin Martyr, Athenagoras, Irenaeus, Tertullian, all of them stress bodily resurrection. What is more, they all link this doctrine very closely to two others, which enable them to stand out against all kinds of other teachings, not least Docetism and Gnosticism. First, the doctrine of creation, and second, the doctrine of God's justice and final judgment. As in Judaism, resurrection is the point where creation and judgment meet. Where one is abandoned, for whatever reason, the others soon follow. With Tertullian in particular, we start to find questions about what precisely bodily resurrection will involve. Some of these questions are also raised in the rabbinic sources, which were wrestling with similar problems around the same time. Suppose a cannibal eats a Christian, and suppose the cannibal is then himself converted. The Christian's body has become part of the cannibal's body. Who will have which bits at the resurrection? Tertullian gives a brusque answer. "It's God's business," he says. "He's the creator, so he can and will sort it out." Origen, faced with similar questions, replies more subtly. "Our bodies," he points out, "are in any case in a state of flux. It isn't just that hair and fingernails grow and are cut off. Our entire physical substance is slowly changing. What we today call atoms and molecules pass through us, leaving us with continuity of form but transience of matter." C.S. Lewis, summarizing this argument, offers an illustration. I am in that respect, he says, like a curve in a waterfall. This argument is repeated by Thomas Aquinas a millennium after Origen, and nearly a millennium before Lewis. It's a good argument. As we now know, we change our entire physical kit, every atom and molecule, over a period of 7 years or so. I am physically a totally different person now from the person I was 10 years ago, and yet I am still me. Thus it really doesn't matter whether we get the identical molecules back or not, though some continuity is perfectly possible. The ones we use for a while have been used by other organisms before us, and will be used by others when we are done with them. Dust we are, and to dust we shall return. But God can do new things with dust. Many of the leading theologians in the patristic and medieval periods were quite clear about the two-stage post-mortem future. Gregory the Great, 540 to 604, for instance, taught that the soul of the dead Christian enjoys the beatific vision while still awaiting the resurrection of the body. Anselm, 1033 to 1109, stressed that our resurrection bodies will transcend our present bodies in a new kind of being. The Victorine theologians, following Hugh of St. Victor, died 1142, taught that the resurrection body will be identical with our earthly body, but transfigured. It will be immune from death and sorrow. It will be at the height of its powers, free from disease and deformity, and around 30 years old, the age at which Christ began his ministry. It will surpass anything we can imagine, even from the accounts of Christ's appearances on earth after his own resurrection. Mainstream medieval theologians like Thomas and Bernard insisted on the bodily resurrection. They, like the New Testament and the early church fathers, held a strong view of God's good creation. They knew that it must be reaffirmed, not abandoned. But a good deal of Western medieval piety then took a very different turn, in which the twin destinations of heaven and hell and the possible intermediate destination of purgatory became far more important, and in which the language of resurrection, insofar as it was retained at all, seemed simply to be a rather special way of talking about heaven, which was the primary category. This has had all kinds of unfortunate results, to which we shall come in a moment. But first, we must draw out and underline the key elements of the early Christian view of the resurrection, and consider how we can reappropriate it for today. Rethinking resurrection today. Who, where, what, why, when, and how? Who will be raised from the dead? All people, according to John, and perhaps Paul, but for Paul at least there is a special sense of resurrection that clearly applies to those who are in Christ and indwelt by the Spirit. This raises other questions that we shall have to address in the next chapter. Where will the resurrection take place? On the new earth, joined as it will then be to the new heaven. That has been the burden of my song in the shape and argument of this whole part of the book. In this new world, there will be no problem of overcrowding, as some at the risk of bathos have ventured to suggest. Apart from the question of whether every human will be raised or only some, we need to remind ourselves that at least 5% of humans who have ever lived are alive at the moment. World population has grown at an enormous rate in the last century. We easily forget that for much of history, huge tracts of land were hardly inhabited at all. Even the civilized and somewhat crowded cities of biblical times were mostly, by today's standards, like small market towns. In any case, if we take seriously the promise of new heavens and new earth, none of this is a problem. God is the creator, and his new world will be exactly what we need and want, with the love and beauty of this present world taken up and transformed. More fully then, what precisely will the resurrection body be? Here I pay homage again to one of the few modern writers who has tried to help us with the task of imagining what the risen body might be like, C.S. Lewis. In a variety of places, but particularly in his remarkable book, The Great Divorce, He manages to get us to envisage bodies that are more solid, more real, more substantial than our present ones. That is the task that 2 Corinthians in particular invites us to. These will be bodies of which the phrase, the weight of glory, taken from that letter, chapter 4, verse 17, will be seen, felt, and known to be appropriate. Further questions were asked in the ancient world at this point, and often re-emerge in contemporary discussion. Which of our present characteristics, and indeed present blemishes, will be retained in the transformed physicality? When I taught a course on resurrection at Harvard in 1999, one of my students complained in her term paper that since she had never liked the shape of her nose, she hoped she wouldn't have to put up with it in a future life as well. There is no way we can answer such questions. All we can surmise from the picture of Jesus' resurrection is that just as his wounds were still visible, not now as sources of pain and death, but as signs of his victory, so the Christian's risen body will bear such marks of his or her loyalty to God's particular calling as are appropriate, not least where that has involved suffering. In particular, this new body will be immortal. That is, it will have passed beyond death, not just in the temporal sense, that it happens to have gone through a particular moment and event, but also in the ontological sense of no longer being subject to sickness, injury, decay, and death itself. None of these destructive forces will have any power over the new body. That, indeed, may be one of the ways of understanding the strangeness of the risen body of Jesus. The disciples were looking at the first, and so far the only, piece of incorruptible physicality. At this point, we must notice that once again our language gets us into trouble. The word immortality is often used to mean disembodied immortality, and it is sometimes then used in a sharp contrast with resurrection. As a result, we easily forget Paul's point about the resurrection body. It will be a body, but it will not be subject to mortality. An immortal body is something most people find so strange that they don't even pause to wonder if that's what Paul and the other early Christians were talking about. But it is. There is a world of difference between this belief and a belief in an immortal soul. Platonists believe that all humans have an immortal element within them, normally referred to as soul. Having praised C.S. Lewis, I should say that he seems to fall into this trap. In the New Testament, however, immortality is something that only God possesses by nature, and that he then shares as a gift of grace, rather than an innate possession, with his people. Why will we be given new bodies? According to the early Christians, the purpose of this new body will be to rule wisely over God's new world. Forget those images about lounging around playing harps. There will be work to do, and we shall relish doing it. All the skills and talents we have put to God's service in this present life, and perhaps too the interests and likings we gave up because they conflicted with our vocation, will be enhanced and ennobled and given back to us to be exercised to his glory. This is perhaps the most mysterious and least explored aspect of the resurrection life. But there are several promises in the New Testament about God's people reigning, and these cannot just be empty words. If, as we have already seen, the biblical view of God's future is of the renewal of the entire cosmos, there will be plenty to be done, entire new projects to undertake, in terms of the vision of original creation in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, the garden will need to be tended once more and the animals renamed. These are only images, of course, but like all other future-oriented language, they serve as true signposts to a larger reality, a reality to which most Christians give little or no thought. The new body will be a gift of God's grace and love. However, there are several passages in the New Testament, not least in the words of Jesus himself, that speak of God's future blessings in terms of reward. A further answer, in other words, to the question why. Many Christians find this uncomfortable, We have been taught that we are justified by faith, not works, and somehow the very idea of being a Christian for what we will get out of it is distasteful. But the image of reward in the New Testament doesn't work like that. It isn't a matter of calculation, of doing a difficult job in order to be paid a wage. It is much more like working at a friendship or a marriage in order to enjoy the other person's company.